now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh no,
how would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Hello and welcome to this week's Ruck. Just before I introduce the panel, here's the scoreline for you. 48-46, that was the score in the Wasps-Harlequins game. Unbelievable game. Exeter scored 41 against Worcester, Newcastle 52, London Irish 27, Bath 20, Bristol 40. What's happened? Is this great attacking rugby or is it candy floss? I'll be very interested to see what Lawrence Dallaglio has to say about 48-46. Today's panel, even better than last week's. Lawrence Dallaglio. Lawrence sounded a little hoarse this morning. I presume that's because you saw so many games with so much to say about them.
Well, it was a fantastic weekend of rugby, if I'm honest. I was lucky enough to be down at the Rec for Bath Bristol. And then, as you say, at the Stoop yesterday, Quins Wasps. And so many talking points, so many different tries. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because everyone's talking about ring fencing and relegation, and sides, obviously, some have a lot to play. You know, Bristol at the top of the table, Quins going for the playoffs, and Wasps and Bath very much down the bottom end, but certainly didn't seem that way.
Also, we've got Owen Slott. Slotty, we'll come to that in a minute, but a fascinating article this morning with Joe Marler, who would have chosen in his Lions team a psychiatrist. We'll come to that shortly. But we haven't got a fanfare, I'm afraid, but he deserves one. Our third panellist today is none other than the doyen of rugby on TV, in fact, of sport on TV, John Inverdale. John, it's great to have you on the show. The long list of your broadcasting achievements, we could take up the whole show, really, but the biggest moment of your career of all, that towering moment, what are your memories of the score you made for the Rugby Writers in Sparta Prague, which won the game?
I think, from memory, it was just under the opposition posts. I took a high ball, I stepped the oncoming flanker, went round the winger, and just went down the touchline fully another 85 yards to score in the corner. That's my recollection of it anyway.
Funny, mine differs about that, but I think it was 5 yards, not 85, but welcome, mate. And are you still coming to terms with the fact that you've now done your last Six Nations game for the BBC?
Well, I suppose it's an easy thing to come to terms with when there isn't a Six Nations game happening. I think the emotional thing will happen, I suppose, inner emotion will happen in the autumn when those internationals happen and I'm not doing them and I'm not at the Principality Stadium or at Murrayfield or wherever it might be. But yeah, I'm happy with it. I mean, I'm just immersed in a zillion committee meetings at Twickenham. So, you know, how could you possibly miss rugby when you're doing that?
Well, that's the other thing, that John is now on the RFU committee. Now, there are not many of us who will be queuing up for that when we eventually retire or get kicked out. But again, John's reasoning is sound, as we will hear. Just go back to you, Lawrence. Wasps won that game, or they had it won. The defence weren't very good, but wearing your Wasp hat, or had you been the Wasp coach, you were more than two scores up at one stage. The match was there to be shut down. Did Wasps really get too full of it when they should have come home with a little bit to spare?
I think it's easy to say, isn't it? Sometimes, I mean, Mike Brown was sent off rather unfortunately. We'll talk about that in a second. But, I mean, for him, hopefully that's not the end of his Quins career. He stepped on Tommy Taylor's head, whether it was accidental or not. It's a tricky one for him because you can't plead guilty, but if you don't plead guilty, you don't get the reduced tariff. So I look forward to how the disciplinary are going to work that one out. But no, listen, if you're Wasps, you're desperately disappointed. They should have won the game, as you said quite rightly. They had one of the two outstanding players on the field. There was a lot of players who put in wonderful performances, but Dan Robson, truly outstanding. Eddie Jones was there, and at some point he might get he may get more than just a sort of 5-minute cameo for England, and he might actually get picked in the position he plays. But the other outstanding performance was obviously Marcus Smith, and sometimes you just got to admire your opponent. And Quinns were so resilient. You know, they stayed in the fight, they stayed in the game, and they got a couple of decisions at the end which went their way. So they deserve to win ultimately.
Jones, I'm chairman, president and fixture set of the Mike Brown fan club. I really am. But that in any day and age, and especially in this day and age, went beyond the unacceptable, you know, and I think he has to receive a lengthy ban. And it's going to be a real shame that is his last game for Harlequins. And that's the last memory that he will have of playing at the Stoop. But there are bigger issues here, there, or rather bigger issues at stake here than there are about just one individual's career. And I just think I watched it over because I knew we were chatting this morning. I just watched it over and over and over again. And this is not me saying, because days gone by, you know, 15 years or so ago, I almost lost an eye when somebody stamped on my face. And I can tell you it's pretty damn frightening. And I watched it over and over again. And, you know, Lawrence, obviously, you know, you've played the game in those situations a million times. But I just sense, you know when there's a player there. You just sense. You have, because you couldn't play rugby at that level without the peripheral vision that means you understand where other players are. That was not acceptable. It really wasn't.
I have to say, I completely agree. And one of the commentators was saying yesterday, they felt really sorry for him because that could be his last game. Well, whose fault is that? I mean, Owen, where do you stand? You're at the game. You've got a good view.
I think it's one of those ones where rugby has to kind of say what it means and take the hard decision, which is say sorry, that's just not what we do. I don't think there's really any argument to be had about it. And I was at the game. I saw Mike Brown trudge off and the look on his face. And he's been at Harlequin 17 years. He's never had a red card before. I mean, what a time to do it. You know, there's no malice in that. Sorry. Well, maybe there was. That's what it looked like. That's the problem. But we don't associate him with as a player who has a record like that or behaves like that. So I do feel sorry for him. But at the same time, I don't think there's really anywhere for the authorities to go on that.
No, there isn't. Lawrence, just going back to these superstars, it was rather an uncomfortable week last week when we found that Warren Gatland had differed with Eddie Jones in a considerable number of positions. When you see Dan Robson and Marcus Smith play like that yesterday, do you feel that sort of that brought it a little even more into focus that Eddie appears to be out of step with almost everybody else when it comes to picking these players?
I think what it reminded me and hopefully everyone is that we've got so many talented players coming through in this country and particularly at halfback. And, you know, you add Joe Simmons into that bracket and there's one or two others as well. You know, they're both superb. And when you look at the performance of Robson and Smith particularly, you just wonder why we haven't seen more of them. But I guess you've got George Ford and Owen Farrell and those players, Smith and Jacob Umanga, you know, will be the next Ford and Farrell. It's just a question of when they bring them in. And you would like to think that whatever tours, test matches go ahead this summer, that there's no point playing Ben Youngs. There's no point playing George Ford if it's going to be against the USA. You know, you should be giving the likes of Umanga, Smith, Robson, that younger generation, the opportunity. Because if not then, when?
You know, sometimes when you're watching a game, you go, oh, that was just so good. And you'll look at Marcus Smith and you'll think about the tries and little kicks and things. About 3 minutes from the end, when Quinns were chasing the victory and they went right and they could, there was a rush defence from the Wasps back line. And if Marcus Smith, whoops, that's unprofessional. My phone going. Apologies, everybody.
Well, you think we're going to cut that out, don't you, John?
Yeah. No, we're not. You're going to leave it there. Anyway, but the Wasps defence rush up. And if Marcus Smith, in the heat of the moment, hadn't had absolute clarity of thought, he would have thrown the pass. It was an intercept down the other end. game over in Wasps' favour. But he held on to the ball. He took the contact, recycled, and they scored. And it, I just thought it was just one of those moments where the great players, or the, and the potentially great players, they're always seeing the bigger picture, even in moments of potential crisis. I thought that was just a defining moment for him.
Oh, and I get sort of jumpy, and I have done since Super 12, Super Rugby started, when the matches ended 86-83 and things like that. Now, I'm not denying for a moment the quality of the game and the skills on show, but does there come a time in the weekend like this where it's almost we score, you score? When people get 50 points, Newcastle 52 and London Irish 27, is there a certain chippening of the currency of a try?
No, I don't think so. I was a bit worried, Jonesy, that you were going to come in with your I hate basketball sort of agenda. And I'm so delighted that you've been so broad-minded about it this morning.
Well, I hate basketball.
I think you've got to bear in mind a few things. It's mid-May. It's hard grounds. And it was a half-decent weekend of weather for the first time in a very long time. So that contributes. And a game like that Wasps-Quins game yesterday, there is a certain contagion when the game starts being played like that, and players are seeking space, and as soon as they've had a sniff, they know it's out there. You know, yeah. Marcus Smith and Dan Robson, the two leading players in that cast, they both got a taste of it so early, and they persevered with it, and that's what made it such a great game to watch.
So on the two other things in here, one is the referee. It's so fundamental. You realise that. And Wayne Barnes had a good game yesterday, which enabled the game to be what it was. And referees, you know, it's still one of the biggest issues that our sport has at any level, from a World Cup final to, you know, old whoever it may be, fifth 15. The referee, in many ways, it can be the most influential person on the field. The other thing about the game at Quins, or the Wasps game yesterday, Quins game, very few scrums. And I only mentioned that because having watched that game on telly yesterday, but on Saturday, I went to watch my club, Isha, play at Chinner, in a full-on match, but with the adapted laws, which because of COVID, which means no scrums. I tell you what, it's a heck of a better spectacle than is sometimes interminable stoppages and resets and things like that. And I just mentioned that because that game on Saturday that I went to watch flew by, and everybody was there. God, that was great, wasn't it? And then you had to think, why was it so enjoyable? And because there were so few stoppages, and we went in the bar, outside bar, observing all the rules afterwards, to watch the kickoff of the Bristol Bath game. And a minute and a half into that game, first scrum, it took 3 minutes for play to resume after the knock-on had happened and the game resumed. And I just think there are lots of elements in that, which, you know, in the winter time, because it's a winter sport, you tend to get more scrums because there are more mistakes, therefore you get more stoppages. You have less. I mean, I'd like to know what the ball in play time was for the game. So all these things are linked about trying to make it a better spectacle. And you could argue that what yesterday did, which going back to what Slotty said, is, you know, should we really not be thinking about rugby union being a summer sport, really? From the elite end to the minis and juniors who'd far rather play on a Sunday morning when the sun's out than a wretched day in November when it's raining.
We'll just come back to John and his denunciation of all we hold dear in rugby in a second. Let's just finish off the weekend, because whether or not it was a great game, and I think it was, Bath-Bristol, Lawrence, amazing start, which Bristol were absolutely dominant, and then were 15 points down. But a great match, great comeback by them, and real quality, just as the Stoop had as well.
Yeah, listen, I think Bristol are a sight to behold, aren't they? Especially when they could bring back the likes of Randrandra, Piatow, Sheedy. I mean, they've got real depth and quality to their squad. I mean, I don't think the game was ever in doubt. They started at 100 miles an hour. They could have been 2, 3, 4 tries up in the opening 10 minutes. As it turned out, quite bizarrely, they were 2 tries down, which did us all a favour, because it looked like it was going to be such a one-sided contest. But actually, Bath, you know, got themselves in front and made Bristol, you know, fight for it, certainly for the for the first 50, 60 minutes. But, you know, when they cut loose, as I said, they're going to take some beating. And they're really the kind of team that have emerged over the last 12 months under Pat Lamb. And every time you hear him speak, there's a real clarity and an authority. And there's a lot to like about Bristol Bears, you know, on and off the field at the moment. And just going back to the speed of the game yesterday and the speed of the game at the Wreck, you know, you're quite right. You know, everyone really, in terms of the weather, the no reset scrums, incredibly well refereed. There's also a few players missing from each side. I mean, if you take Will Evans away from Harlequins and you take Jack Willis away from Wasps, what you've got is about a season tally of about 60 turnovers between them, really, if not more. And, you know, that was quite evident yesterday that both sides were winning a lot of ball, or there was a penalty or at the breakdown, but there was very few turnovers. So I think it's very exciting. I really enjoyed it. The first scrum penalty came on about 60 minutes, so that made a huge difference. And as I said, I'd agree with Slotty. Sometimes it gets infectious, that kind of rugby. The referee plays their part, but so do both teams. And that's probably one of the reasons why Wasps lost yesterday, because they were seduced into playing in a way that they didn't need. They didn't need to play, really.
Lads, just before we go on, just have a little final word to date on the Premiership. Four teams are now broken away. Looks like Quins are impossible to catch in fourth place. So you've got Bristol on 71 points, Exeter 63, Sale and Harlequins both on 59. And those two teams are yet to play each other. That looks like being the top four. Is that for you, Owen, the strongest top four that there's been for a while? And of all those four teams got a genuine chance of the title?
If it's the strongest top four there's ever been, I don't really know what to say. Trying to put that in context is hard. Yeah, is it that strong a top four when you think that Harlequins were pretty dreadful for the first 2 months of the season? So they haven't had to be consistent, but actually they're better. But because of the way they've come and they haven't had that consistency, that proves how strong they are now. So I think it's a really exciting top four because can I see Harlequins upsetting Bristol, for instance, in a semi-final? Yes. Can you see Sale upsetting Exeter? Less likely, because I think Exeter are still the favourites, but still, yes. So I think the positive part of that is too often we've got to the last four and it's been kind of a procession for the two home teams, and I don't think that's the case this time.
Okay, Lawrence, this four away, and do you feel that is it Exeter or Bristol? Probably Exeter at the moment, or are Sale or Harlequins, do they have the armoury to get through?
Exeter is still a very, very good side, but I watched the Bristol-Exeter game down at Sandy Park where Bristol came away, you know, comfortable winners. So I think they've got the belief that they can beat the Chiefs, you know, wherever they play them. And actually, Quins were rather unfortunate to, ironically, concede a Carl Stinkler try in the last minute and lost to Ashton Gate. So again, they will have the belief that they can win. But really, the Bristol and Exeter have been consistently good, not just this season, but last season as well and the season before. Whereas I think what we see in the Premiership is a lot of other sides that flip-flop a little bit. And yes. Sale and Quins would be one. Last year, it was Wasps that were the top. Look at where they are now. Bath were in the playoffs. Look at where they are. And I think the challenge for the chasing pack against the likes of Exeter and Bristol is to create this consistency. And when your director of rugby goes out the door, you know, you seem to see an uplift. And yeah, so I think there needs to be a consistency. Will Quins and Sale be there again next year? Or will it be, I don't know, Wasps or Bath? Who knows? But,
sure.
But there's certainly a lot to admire.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
We just want to know to the Inverdale blueprint for the future. Isha and Chinna. John, you're saying that you don't like scrums. Do your Isha front row forwards agree with you?
Well, they probably don't. But the thing about it is, because they were, everybody had their hands on their knees because the game just never stopped. And there's always the debates about, oh, it's becoming like rugby league and, you know, it's almost like glorified sevens and things like that. It's all about having a bigger vision for what the game needs to be. You know, at the time when, you know, this is suddenly getting very big here, but almost existential. But at the time when CVC are coming in here and potentially private equity into New Zealand and things like that, we're starting to get new stakeholders in this game, and they will want the game to be as saleable as is humanly possible. And allied to that, just going off on a slight tangent here, you know, one of the reasons you and I have had this conversation 100 million times over the last 30 years or so, you know, the gulf between the haves and the have-nots in the international game. One of the reasons it's always set pieces and scrums and mauls and things where the second tier nations find themselves just getting beaten up for all sorts of reasons. Actually, if the laws were changed slightly, shaped slightly differently, so that these elements of the game weren't quite so fundamental, you could have the Italys and the Georgias and the Spains and whoever else it might be actually eating at the top table a bit more than they're able to do at the moment. I think there's a whole bigger issue here about what is the product and what is the aim to try
what
and make...
The bigger issue of sport, of rugby being the ideal vehicle for people of all shapes and sizes.
Yeah, that's an ethic that's gone down, you know, from we were brought up with that and all that sort of stuff. But actually, it's less true now than it was 20 years ago, and it's certainly less true now than it was 40 years ago. You know, you've got an awful lot of guys. Okay, you've got the Marcus Smiths of this world, you know, and you've got small scrum halves, you've got Faf de Klerk, you know, which is fantastic. You'd still have him, but I just, you know, is it wrong to actually look to want the game to be as big as it can possibly be in terms of the number of people genuinely interested in watching it? And if that is the objective, if that is the prime objective, which I think it should be, then serious consideration has to be given to certain elements of the game that frankly are dull. And top of that list, by the way, is penalty kicks, which are utterly interminable. And why on earth we can't just instantly do it, could do it tomorrow, that you put a shot clock on the scoreboard. You've got 25 seconds. If you can make Rafael Nadal speed up his service action, you can speed Owen Farrell and Dan Biggar up at the place kick. So I'm sorry, just little things like that, bit by bit, understanding the need of broadening the appeal of the game. It's not that difficult.
Lawrence, many of the characters you play with were front row forwards, and John's recommending here, or at least he's lauding something which is really anathema to many. Do you agree, or do you think that actually CVC, their investment has now come in, and surely what they were buying was rugby as possibly as we'd like it to be, but rugby actually as it is at the moment? Will you go so far as John and start saying we don't want real scrums and we want to hurry up the penalties?
Well, I think the scrum is unrecognisable now from what it was however many years ago. And the lawmakers have always tried to sort of gently tweak different parts of the game, particularly at the scrum, really on the basis of safety. And I think that is paramount. Health and safety are obviously very, very important. But equally, I do agree with John in the sense that we do need to look at ways that we can speed the game up and the scrum and reset scrum, and should there be, you know, should we stop the clock, you know, so that we don't lose time to reset scrums, you know, all of the above. But that relies on a number of things. It relies on the stakeholders of the game, whether that be governing bodies, the players, referees, broadcasters, to all sit around the table together. And that doesn't seem to happen really that often. It takes the governing body of club rugby quite some time to actually announce to the owners of each club that they've actually got a new TV deal, let alone sit around the table together. So, I'm 100% in agreement that we need to do things to speed up the game and make it more attractive and make it more palatable for and to help grow the audience. I question whether rugby is exponentially grown since the advent of professionalism. You might tell me yes, it has, but I don't think it has. I don't think the investment has gone into making the game grow, both in terms of the marketing of the sport and the laws of the game.
I really think, and I think that's one of the most disappointing things that's happened in the game in the last 25 years, that it should have been the springboard for the game to really explode. And that hasn't happened. And there's responsibilities all over the place for that. Just very quickly, though, on what you were saying about stopping the clock. That game at the Stoop yesterday was over 2 hours long. The problem is, if you keep stopping the clock every time there's a scrum until the ball's back in play, you're starting to look at a 2.5 hour game of rugby, which broadcasters aren't going to want. You know, I think there's an issue. The big issue, the issue in many ways, and I'm not backtracking here, the issue here is not the scrum, it's reset scrums. If every scrum was down once and the ball was away in whatever form it might be, then that's not too bad. But it's the second, the third, the reset. And remember that, I mean, the Wales-France, unbelievable finale in the Six Nations. Up until the unbelievable finale at the end, we'd had about 2 or 3 minutes, hadn't we, of time wasting with scrums going down and down and down. That's not entertainment. That's not sportertainment. And I'm afraid once you're in the industry of taking millions, some 200 million or something plus TV contracts and things like that, it's the duty of the game to not have moments of unbelievable downtime when people just say, what's going on here? I'm off here now. But there is a responsibility on both sides.
I disagree totally with about the scrum. I think the scrum is fantastic. Yeah, we don't want it all to go down, but the scrum is the engine of the game. It's given rugby some great characters, and it creates space on the field when one scrum is on top. And the problem with the scrums, as far as I'm concerned, is that they won't let people scrummage properly. When the ball's in the back foot, instead of the secondary shove, which used to be really damaging, they now call for the ball to be out. But Owen, with a certain support from Lawrence, we appear to be talking about something very, very basic changing in the game. Where do you stand?
I just think it's going to change anyway. I think it's almost unstoppable. And I don't think that's because of CVC or private equity. I just think people will start to understand that to keep the game moving in the right direction, that will happen. And I tell you specifically why I say that, because in New Zealand, where you might think they are the high priests of the great game as we once knew it, etc., they have made dramatic changes to their community game this season, law tweaks and all sorts of things. I was speaking to the chief executive, Mark Robinson, of New Zealand Rugby a couple of weeks ago about this. And he says, we just had to do this because for years, for decades, we've had rugby and we thought, let's just attract people to rugby because that's our job. He says, we've had a complete mindset change on that. It's now, how should we change rugby to persuade people that they should be playing it? So they've had a completely refreshed look at it. So I think if that catches on, you got France looking at tackling below the waist. I think this is a slow, it's snowballing this. Hopefully it'll take rugby to a better place. But yes, it's contentious. And do I think they'll do away with the scrum? No, because I think everyone knows that that's essential to part of it and to a game for all.
I think that it'll take it to another place, but some of the things we're talking about here would take the game to a very dark place because it'll disappear right up its own backside. When you start chasing a concept of entertainment, where do you stop? And I tell you something, there's a 48-46 game yesterday. Brilliant. If there's another one next week, okay. By the third week of a 48-46 game, you're dying for a real hard, blistering contest. Having had the last word there, Bradley Inver didn't have to go on, didn't he? No, he's not the presenter anymore. Now we're talking about Joe Marler and the Times story this morning. Lawrence and Owen, you were the author. Joe was calling for a psychiatrist to go on the Lions tour. The first thing you think is, go, what's Marler on about now? The second thing you think of is, blimey, what a good idea and what an essential idea for a tour that's going to be slightly lonely and different and distracting experience. Joe's talking sense there.
Yeah, he is. So Joe's got a documentary coming out on Sky on Wednesday called Big Boys Don't Cry, and it's an examination of his own mental health issues. And he kind of goes, it's an investigation for him of how he can make himself better, how he can seek a cure, and just to tell people what he's been through, if you like. And so he's talking about rugby, and we all know it's the traditionally alpha male type game, and the change room's not the easiest place to discuss your mental lows and your concerns. And he talks about that a lot, but I think he makes sense. I mean, just step aside from the fact that he thinks a clinical psychologist should come on the tour. ever since I started writing about sport, people have been saying that that the game is won in the head. You know, if you've got two equal teams, it's the team that have the most belief in that. How many teams have more than one sports psychologist in their management and training staff? You have umpteen strength and conditioning experts and analysts and the like, and maybe one sports psychologist per team. I think in 10 years' time, you'll probably have four or five, and that clinical side that Joe's talking about, it is just one part of it.
Lawrence, you're very close to the modern day player. Do you see the same needs as Joe Mahler there?
Yes, I do. Although I think that the players themselves have got a duty to look after each other off the field as well. You know, the head and the heart are obviously inextricably linked. And when you take the field with another player, you kind of know exactly what's going on in their head and their heart. I think, you know, you've got a duty to look after each other. And those little chats that you have, you know, in between training sessions are really, really important to understanding and getting players to open up, looking after each other, making sure that you're in a good shape mentally, because it is important to have that. And many of the coaches that you've talked about, whether it be the head coach, the backs coach, the forwards coach, defence, kicking, whatever they might be, they're also mentors to the players individually as well. And they do provide some of that kind of counselling on the mental side of the game. Dave Allred, you know, was often seen as a kicking coach to Johnny Wilkinson alone. But actually the work that he did on the mental side of the game was huge for a number of players in the England squad. And I can understand where Joe Mahler's coming from, because this Lions tour is going to be mentally a big struggle for a lot of players, because if there's not that many good quality midweek games, I'm sorry to say, and therefore there's going to be a lot of bag carrying for a lot of those players, then they're only going to be seeing the inside of, albeit very nice, hotels, team buses, stadiums, and they're not actually going to be able to get out into the country and actually experience the true sense of what touring's all about. So I think they need to mentally prepare themselves for that before they go away. So yeah, I would advocate that if you can get a bit of help with that, it's going to be a tough 9 weeks. I mean, can you imagine being covering the tour, which you will be, and not being able to, you're not even sure whether you're going to be able to leave your hotel room. So it's a hard ask. So I think the more help that the players get with that, the better, for sure.
John, in the ruck, we sometimes accused of only looking at the pro game. You've got a long and proud record of administrating and supporting not so much the community game, but sort of other levels of the top of the game. It's a very difficult question, but how badly has the game been affected by lockdown and by RFU cuts? Can it reemerge in any sort of recognisable and good fashion?
I think actually there's a lot of optimism about what the future holds. I think the last 15 months or so has given a lot of clubs, which are run by very well-meaning and often very, very efficient and switched on individuals, but who are often doing it very much part-time to fit in with the rest of their lives. Over the last 15 months, those individuals have had more time actually to say, how is this club run? How do we spend our money? How could we do this? What about if we did that? And so actually, I think a lot of clubs are almost in a better position now than they were 15 months ago. The funding, I mean, it's interesting you should mention that, because obviously that's a huge issue at the moment. And I'm only realising, having been on the RFU council for, 8 months, 9 months, and I haven't had a single meeting face-to-face with anybody. So everything's done on Zoom so far. But you just realise how key funding is, whether it's, how much money should the RFU be giving the Premiership? Because, they are multi-million pound industries. Should they be standing on their own 2 feet? And then the RFU paying them X when England players are called upon. How much money should the RFU be giving to Devon League 3 clubs to keep them in existence? So there are lots of fundamental issues about the RFU that I still personally, even though I'm on the inside now, I still kind of feel a bit on the outside because I haven't been part of it for real. I'm still trying to come to terms with what I think the RFU actually should do and what its 1, 2, and 3 priorities ought to be.
John, it's got its an image of moving with desperate slowness. I mean, Premiership rugby, as Lawrence said, moves with desperate and secretive slowness. But is anything happening at Twickenham on the committee? I mean, I never come across people who are on the committee. I never come across what I think to be radical moves. Is below the surface, are good things happening?
Well, define radical.
Something that's different to what we've always done.
In what respect, though?
Well, something that's visionary, that people haven't thought of before and that works and that can be delivered.
I mean, on that subject, you know, this is not visionary, but it's been unbelievable. The single most interesting thing, and I forgive Lawrence if he falls off to sleep on this, but at the same time, it's quite interesting for most people listening to this, they may have more personal engagement in this. It was agreed at the RFU council meeting 2 weeks ago that second and third and fourth 15s should be allowed to play in the pyramid of league rugby. Now, that may not strike you as being visionary or radical, but actually, in the context of rugby generally, it is, because it, while it happens in certain parts of the country, it's actually there's huge antipathy and resentment of it in other parts of the country. Now, to get that through the council required an unbelievable amount of cajoling, explaining, just saying, look, for the good of the game, you know, playing numbers are dropping, going back to what Owen was saying, you know, we've got to do things that we think will get matches fulfilled, get people playing the game. Just give it a go. Don't be so entrenched in the past. You've got to look at the forward, at the future, and you've got to look forward and say this may be for the betterment of the game. Now, that's just one example of something that took an unbelievable amount of getting through RFU Council. So that's when I come back to the issue here about, is the RFU the leader of the sport, and it has people at its helm who are visionary and who say this is what we're going to do for the sport, or is the RFU the voice of its members? And I still think it doesn't quite know which of those two it is. And it's a bit like being an MP. It's a bit like being a, you know, for a lot of council members, it's a bit like being a Remainer MP in a Brexit constituency or vice versa. If you genuinely believe that something is the way the game should be going, but your member clubs don't believe that, how do you vote? And that's a bit that's the structure makes that an issue that reoccurs time and time again.
And I think the crux of that, John, is as well, is if you feel that way, can you imagine the people on the outside, what they're thinking about the RFU? And I've said this to Bill Sweeney on a couple of occasions. I said, I'm not quite sure the RFU really understands what its role is in the game anymore. Mm. And I'm not sure we as fans of rugby understand what the RFU stands for. Is it the guardian and custodian of professional rugby? Is it the guardian and custodian of amateur rugby? Is it both? What is its role within that? You know, obviously the national team is really important. So I'd love Bill Sweeney to invite, when we can, invite every single rugby club or a representative of every rugby club down to Twickenham, host them in the live room or even host them in the stadium and actually address them with the core values of what the RFU actually means, the vision for the game. Because I think that we do need to unify the game again and reestablish the, you know, the principles of what we're all trying to do and trying to achieve together. And, you know, we seem to do it in pockets in amateur rugby, in community rugby, in professional rugby, but surely we're all in this together. And if they don't want to run the professional game, then don't run it. And as you say, just bring in the England players when they want them.
Talking about reuniting the game, Lyle, you're so right though, because at the moment there's a huge amount of antipathy towards the professional game from clubs at the lower end, because they think that they're having all their travel funding cut. They feel they've been cast adrift a bit, and they see, rightly or wrongly, they see the rugby union becoming more embedded with the Premiership. And yet, I'm sure most Premiership clubs almost feel that the rest of the game is almost irrelevant. In certain areas, there are those that understand the importance of National League clubs for developing players and all that sort of stuff. But there are a lot of people involved in the Premiership who I've spoken to who barely know, you know, that there's a junior club 4 miles down the road from where they live. And so, okay, I think the whole thing about how you unite the game is a... Goodness me, if do you fancy the job?
Owen, could you sum up your feelings on the RFU and unity?
Well, yeah, I think Inver's just had it that Lawrence should be there taking the job of uniting the game.
I think he should.
Well, taking some responsibility for what you stand for and being prepared to go on record and say it and talk about it. I mean, you know, you talk about players needing to get their views and you know, what they think privately and publicly. I just think we as fans need to reestablish what the game stands for. And I, you know, I would implore the RFU to do that as and when, maybe they don't know yet, but when they've got their manifesto sorted and John and all the guys have got an agreement on that, then please explain it to the rest of us, because we haven't got a clue what the RFU stand for. And I think that's sad, really, because I love the RFU. I love English rugby. But I want to be brought back in to understand what it really means and what direction we're going in, because, you know, financially, there is some serious issues. You know, I see the RFU have got to guarantee their loans for the first time ever. They seem to have gone from a situation where they've been debt-free for a number of years to being, you know, riddled with financial debt at the moment, which is a concern, because if they are, then where does that leave the rest of the game?
Can I have a slightly more grown-up attempt at answering your question?
Slotty, could you give us a grown-up version of answering the question?
Yes. I think what the RFU really has to try and establish is what constitutes a business that should be running on its own. What clubs, businesses, a club is a business, what club should it be funding? Because it's so easy to look at any part of the game and say, oh, the RFU should be helping them. The RFU should be helping them. So that the championship, oh, the RFU should be propping up the championship. Well, should it be propping up the championship, or should the championship be able to stand on its own two feet? That's what no one can work out. And that's why whichever end of the game you're at, you can say, well, the RFU is giving money to them. It should be to us. Well, who should be able to stand on their own two feet, and who should the RFU be funding? And
well, very good point.
That's an incredibly hard question.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but John, we have to going to come back to RFU committee affairs in a later program. And well done for speaking. And well done for, after all your successful career, putting yet more back into the game. At this stage, we go on to picking our God or goddess of the week. It's been an unbelievable week, Owen. Who's your god or goddess?
Well, it's slightly strange that I saw Marcus Smith and Dan Robson playing yesterday, and I'm going to choose neither of them. Maybe not strange at all. My god of the week is Kyle Sinclair, who has been for a long time one of my very, very favourite players. The one thing that I really don't like about Kyle Sinclair is that he won't come out and talk more publicly and to the media, because he's such a compelling character. He speaks so well, and I think he should be the poster boy for what the future of rugby should and could be like. And we've just had a snapshot of him this week being denied his place on the Lions tour. He didn't get the vote from Warren Gatland, fair enough. But the way he took it with his man of the match performance for Bristol at the weekend, and then that extraordinary interview afterwards when he basically said, "I had to be a man and take it on the chin," I thought was just wonderful. It's been replayed a million and one times over Twitter. If you haven't seen it, then it ain't hard to find. So Kyle Sinclair for me.
Very powerful there. Lawrence.
Not a million miles away from Owen, actually. I mean, I agree on Kyle Sinclair. I mean, these guys need to be household names and right across the country. And the sooner that the press officers of clubs and the union realise that actually the best people to promote the game are the players. They do it wonderfully. But not far away from that, Kyle Sinclair, my goddess of the week was the wonderful broadcaster and lady who interviewed him, Sarah Elgin, because I thought she was both, you know, sensitive around the emotion and the feelings and the way she posed the question. So Sarah Elgin is my goddess of the week.
Well, two very, very strong candidates there. John?
Well, I was going to go for Warren Gatland, actually, because, you know, I'm a huge fan of Gats. I just, you know, Lawrence obviously played under him and all that sort of stuff. I just think he's a great figurehead for the sport, but I won't do that because he's you know, our age.
Kiwi.
He's yeah absolutely. I'm going to be boring and go for Marcus Smith, just because I watched. He came down to Esher a few times to train and all that sort of stuff. And everybody, when he was 18, you know, was more actually younger than that, and everyone said, "God, this guy is so good." And you could just see he had so much time on the ball; it was just staggering. And yesterday was one of those matches when you thought it is like the oldest cliche about whether it's a tennis player or a cricketer, just time, just that extra nanosecond where everything opens up in front of them that other players don't have that peripheral vision, that understanding of the game. And I thought there were half a dozen moments in the match yesterday where you thought, goodness me, this guy is so good.
Okay, well, despite my doubts about certain aspects of the game yesterday, I'm going to go with Dan Robson. I feel so sorry for the guy. I feel he's been treated abysmally. But to come out in probably the not the latter stages of his career, but certainly the second half, play so well at the end of the season, such electricity of mind and thought. I thought he was fantastic. So I think possibly what we could do is go with four joint winners of the God or Goddess of the Week. This time, four people who serve the game brilliantly in so many ways. So thanks a million to Lawrence and to Owen, and especially to you, John. It's great to see you. I'm sure you'll be back if we can afford you. Just on the final note about the way the game's going and scrummaging, I will be taking the scrummaging session for the Maidenhead Iron Maidens on Thursday night. We will be doing 2 hours of full-on scrummaging. We will be practicing resetting the scrums. We will be bringing in the dark arts, and we will be slowing the game down, and we will be having a ball. Thank you. That was the ruck.
If you did do that on Thursday, you'd actually be contravening the rules of the game because you can't have scrums till next week.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.